32 teams will compete in this summer's World Cup. It gets underway tomorrow week. That is all that is left standing after 820 matches involving 203 countries spread across six confederations in qualifying. And obviously the biggest names in the world, the biggest teams in international football will be the subject of all our attention, and in some cases the recipients of what glory we can give upon them in the coming weeks. However, the best stories from qualifying often involve those sides who never really had any chance of making the finals. James Montague has compiled the stories of many of the teams that you don't get to hear that much about in his new book, 31-0, On the Road with Football's Outsiders, A World Cup Odyssey. For the most part here, we're not dealing with global superstars. We're dealing in many cases with players who are making massive personal sacrifices to compete for their country. You're dealing with the international game, and what a lot of people say it really should mean, close enough to being in its purest form.
What I wanted to do with writing 31-0 was to tell the story of a qualification campaign, but through the teams that will never qualify for it, largely. And, and obviously 31-0 references American Samoa, which was the greatest ever victory or defeat, whichever way you look at it, against Australia. For me, travelling around the world, all six continents, finding these teams and the incredible stories of why they would pick themselves up qualification campaign after qualification campaign. You know, it really did. I rediscovered the spirit of football that I fell in love with, because, you know, they're not playing for money. They're not playing, in large cases, not playing for pride because they're getting hammered, and they're not playing for glory. So what is it they're playing for? And it's just the smallest chance, the hint of a chance that they might get to the next round. And they might be the team, because every World Cup's got it. Every World Cup has got the team that makes it to the final. It could be the UAE in 1990, or kind of Cameroon in 1990 as well. And you've got Kuwait in 1982, Zaire, Haiti 74, 66, obviously North Korea. And most of the time they get hammered, but occasionally you get North Korea, Portugal, and this from out of left field, that a team that nobody knows makes it to the World Cup finals. And I wanted to find out the process that takes 3 years, that covers, hundreds of matches, that covers over 200 teams, and find the stories of what's really going, like this under this iceberg. You know, the tip of the iceberg is the 32, the elite that get to Brazil. But I wanted to speak to and find out the stories. And also, you know, in a way, you know, football's very reflective as well of the world. And what it is this journey over time. Even most of the people I spoke didn't make it to the World Cup finals. It's a potted history of the world over 3 years. So you kind of understand some of the reasons why Eritrean footballers, for instance, decide that they need to, the only way they can leave the country is if they play for the international football team and abscond whilst on international duty. Or in Haiti, where, you know, there was so little positive going on, that the return of the national team after the earthquake, with their first game after the earthquake, was just this fantastic outpouring of grief and joy at the same time. Or the Palestinians, who had their first ever home international game, you know, in the West Bank in June 2011. And through these stories, I wanted it to be the story of what was going on in the world at that time.
In football, particularly at international level, there is the greatest inherent snobbery that you can encounter. The notion, for example, like Gibraltar are in the Republic of Ireland's group for the European qualifiers, the suggestion that those minnow nations shouldn't be involved, shouldn't be allowed down at the international table. You hear stories like American Samoa, the Kosovan soccer team, the Palestinian soccer team. The people who have put forward that narrative have no idea of what international football in reality is about.
People don't want to see just the elites. They want to see the chance of an upset. They want to see David versus Goliath. That's what they want to see. You know, they've expanded the European Championships, and there are lots of, say, weaker teams. But I asked Gianpaolo Mazza, who's the coach of the San Marino team, who's just quit after 17 years. It's he was the longest-serving coach in Europe at the time, national team coach. And he had conceded 54 goals. He'd only scored one goal. He'd never had a competitive victory before. And I asked him, what do you say to people to say you shouldn't be playing England? And he explained to me what it was like playing at Wembley. 90,000 people went and saw him at Wembley, and I think it was 5-0 or 4-0, I can't remember exactly the result. You know, it was a hammering, and they got cheered off the field louder than the England team did. You know, and he said to me, you know, even Usain Bolt, you know, this is sport, this is the absolute crux of sport. The weak play the strong, and the great come out of it. And And for me, that kind of encapsulated it. You know, there might be 99 times out of 100, Usain Bolt would smash the field in the first qualifying round at the Olympics in 2012. But one time, this David will come out and just sprint past him. And maybe he won't even get through the second round. But that moment is worth, for me, 10 titles for Manchester City. It's worth 10 World Cups for Brazil. You know, for every San Marino goal in the first 15 seconds against England, you know, I mean, you know, it's worth a dozen qualification campaigns for anybody else. And that's what people remember, and that's what people want. And the final thing he said to me, which I thought was brilliant, was, you know, what is it about underdogs? Why are we drawn to them? And he said, well, they're a reflection of us. Mm. They're a reflection of the normal person, the average person. There could be some kind of, you know, alignment of the stars, and you as a pub footballer could suddenly be at Wembley. And that's what the hope against hope. But it can only be hope against hope if occasionally, like once in a generation or once every 4 years, one team emerges that, you know, that does actually get there or does do something. And it's becoming rarer and rarer in the professionalisation of football worldwide. But, you know, there is that one. And this time, you know, it was almost the smallest country to ever make it to World Cup finals, which is Iceland, who got to the playoffs.
And again, as well, it all depends on what your barometer of success is. I should almost be on a residual at this stage. I've recommended Next Goal Wins, the film, to so many people about the American Samoan team. But you look at the emotion involved there, and at one point in the film, the sole target is to score a goal. You know, that is what success would be. That we've completely lost track of all of that within this world of, you know, £250,000 after tax footballers and endorsement deals and golden boots and everything else that goes with it.
Well, look, I mean, beautiful football, you know, exists and it's out there. But if it's all you wanted, then nobody would watch any other football than the Champions League. You know, there are grades down. Then, of course, you know, the Premier League is worse than the Champions League. And then nobody would watch non-league football. You know, I went to Apia, the capital of Samoa, where Next Goal Wins was, some of Next Goal Wins was filmed. And I spoke to the filmmakers, and we were there for much the same reason. Their film started out about an American Samoa team that was largely hopeless, continually hopeless, had never won a game, had only scored two goals in its history, and was to find out what it was that kept these people going. But when we got there, we met Thomas Rongen, the coach, you know, we thought, oh, hang on a second, something's up here. This guy has knocked this team into some form of shape within a month. And I can tell you, you know, meeting Jaya Salua, the transgender centre-back, and watching her boss that game, I know it's against a Tongan front line that, you know, wouldn't even get into, you know, a non-league side in England, but watching her boss that and watching them score their first goal and watching them win, and what it meant to them, what it meant to Nicky Salapu, the goalkeeper who was there on that day. He was a goalkeeper that let in 31 goals, a guy whose life had been ruined by this victory, you know, or defeat. And to see that, it was the most beautiful moment I've ever experienced in sport. It was incredible. And to say that doesn't matter because it's just lower level football, you know, it's codswallop. This was one of the greatest achievements, you know. You know, you can have a Brazil win a World Cup, or you can have an Argentina win a World Cup, but for them to do that, you know, I think is almost a much larger leap forward than those teams succeeding. So, or at least, you know, the same. And I think there's room for both. There's room for the elite, but there's room for these guys as well. And without the underdog, without the teams, sport as a spectacle and as something that is rooted still to the people that watch it and pay for it, is dead.
It's interesting as well, and it comes across in the American Samoan story, but likewise, you know, the Palestine and Kosovan story, that in many cases, for a lot of people involved within the country, the soccer team on the international level is almost the sole positive international coverage, or the sole positive personification in a way of the national identity. And that means much more than we can understand from a distance.
I mean, one of the reasons I've been so interested in international football for so long is because it's so political, you know, especially when you look at how dictators and presidents are absolutely addicted to international football in the World Cup. It's some kind of catnip. For them, you know, a national team going to a World Cup is this, kind of imprimatur, like that this country is a real player. You know, you can see dictators through the ages have sought to appropriate the national team and to use the World Cup as some form of, you know, some kind of stamp of approval in the world. And it was no different this time round, really. You know, with the Palestinians, they have a national team, but they don't have a nation. They're recognised by FIFA. And, you know, this World Cup campaign, you could tell football and the national team has become really the sole international symbol, that is recognised outside of the borders. And, you know, all the problems they experience as a football team, and I talk about this in the chapter where players from Gaza can't travel to the West Bank to play with their players, so they only meet each other when they're abroad, and the fact that they'll play in Afghanistan, in Tajikistan, because there were problems in Kabul, and, you know, and coming back, and they were playing their first match ever in the West Bank, which was this kind of incredible moment that the Prime Minister turned up at. It was a act of state, almost. It's one of the few places a Palestinian flag can be flown and where they can be equals. And these teams will not get better playing amongst themselves. They need to play the top teams. So you have a team like Iceland, who I mentioned earlier, who were one of the worst teams historically in Europe, with a population of 300,000, were in the bottom pot when the draw was made for the 2014 World Cup qualification in the first place, and yet finished second in their group. If they had just been given a group draw with Faroe Islands, whatever, I mean, you know, they would never have emerged, I don't think, to be a force. Or certainly it would have been far harder for them to do that. And they came very close. I mean, they drew 0-0 with Croatia in the first leg of the playoff, lost 2-0 in Zagreb in the second one. But for a country of 300,000, I mean, that's a town in England. You know, and we complain in England about the fact that you know, the talent isn't coming through, the players aren't coming through. You look at that England team, I mean, it's pretty good, but we have this discussion every 4 years about the lack of English talent being crowded out of. Go to Iceland, go and see a place that is 300,000, you know, inhabitants, and, you know, half the country is under snow, you know, or the country's under snow for half the year. And you see that Iceland playing international football with the best has brought the best out of them.
There were two stories in particular in terms of how football can unite and can help to heal old wounds that really stood out for me. A lot of people listening to this interview will have relatives or perhaps themselves have been part of the Irish Defence Forces in the Lebanon. Remarkable how so many aspects of society have been united in sport. That one, it was one in particular that stood out for me. The other one was the image of fans flocking to the stadium in Rwanda, where such a horror had been carried out 20 years ago, but yet it seems for a large extent to have been forgotten, and they are all united around the people that carry the flag on the international stage.
Yeah, I mean, both stories, you know, on the surface were about unity, and football is an incredibly unifying thing, but it can also be very divisive, and both stories have got a kind of caveat to them. And with the Lebanon story, you know, I mean, Lebanon have been terrible on the international stage for so long. They're actually the lowest ranked Asian team when they went into the initial group stage, so nothing was expected of them. And the main reason for that is because the football, like the society, is divided by sectarian lines. So the football club, you have teams like Al Ahed, which is run by Hezbollah, which has a Shia identity, and others have a Catholic identity, Maronite Catholic identity, Sunni identity, and fans were banned from the football matches for 5 years. Because I was so worried about the violence kind of spilling over. And there's a lot of strong coaches in 31-0. And this German coach, Theo Bucher, turns up and he pulls these players together and says, I do not care about corruption or nepotism or sectarian allegiances. I will play the best players and I will drop you if you're terrible. And he knocked these players together, and suddenly, and anyone who's been to Beirut or Lebanon knows that it is a country of flags. Nobody listens to the police because there's no central control. There's sectarian militias. So you see those flags and you rarely see the Lebanese flag. But what happened when this team started winning, you had like 60,000 people in the main stadium watching them beat South Korea. Incredible journey for them to go, one of the best teams in Asia, semi-finalists in the World Cup, and they beat them in front of a stadium of people of every single sectarian persuasion holding these flags. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing. Again, the real problem with Lebanon is corruption and nepotism and sectarianism, so this did actually later on rear its head, where it turned out several of the players were involved in match fixing, had thrown some of the World Cup matches, or at least their performances were directly responsible for it. So in the end, the public had believed this team and had believed in the unifying issues when it came to football or its power. And then they had their kind of dream shattered by the fact that what it came down to really was a couple of guys who were just too greedy and took the money. And it was kind of a heartbreaking story in the end. With Rwanda, again, yeah, you know, it was about the national team in this Amahoro Stadium, which had become a kind of almost refuge, one of the rare places where the UN had any control, and it was shelled by Hutus and Tutsis. I mean, there were 10,000 of Tutsis living in there. I read a book about the conditions in there, absolutely horrific. So this is a real symbol, this national stadium, of refuge for the people that survived. And so they came to it and they got behind this national team. But the underlying, you know, issue was that people had forgotten in a, I think, quite an unhealthy way. You know, there was no Truth and Reconciliation Committee where people could have confronted their murderers, because wherever you go in Kigali, there are people almost every two steps who are missing limbs, and next to them will be people in those communities who are responsible for that. But Paul Kagame, the kind of quite authoritarian president, what he's done is essentially said, well, listen, we're just going to forget about it, we're not going to talk about it, and then it's never going to be an issue. And football, you know, had become, and this national team had become, something of let's talk about the new Rwanda. But I found it actually, It was quite sinister in a way, because none of the issues of the past had been dealt with, and nobody'd asked for forgiveness from anybody. And if we learn anything from Northern Ireland or from Lebanon in particular, you know, if you don't deal with the resentments of the past, then you just go through a cycle of violence.
Which experience or which country had the biggest impact on you?
The biggest impact was probably on my lungs, because I breathed in so much tear gas during the. I mean, ridiculous. I felt like a war correspondent at the time. I mean, Egypt is a place that I've wrote a lot for When Friday Comes, and that, again, I mean, there's a story in there. I spent a lot of time with Bob Bradley. So, you know, that was the first time I got tear gassed, and I remember seeing the canister land at my feet, and I was taking a photo thinking, oh, that's not too bad. And then the pain, like I wanted to scratch my eyes out. I thought I was going to die. It was awful. But I mean, Brazil really, you know, because there's not a lot of underdogs in Brazil. So I went there to do a story about Tahiti at the Confederations Cup. And that's what the chapter's about. But quickly, it turns into a chapter about the people who are protesting on the streets and very unhappy about what was happening in corruption-wise and the kind of almost the racial inequalities in society. And being there and going from city to city and to ground, being tear gassed and fired on by riot police and flash grenades, it changed my perception of the country. Mainly positively, I have to say, because the people I saw, they weren't, some of them were hooligans, but the majority of the people there were fighting for, I think, a better Brazil. And it turned something, a cliche I had in my mind about samba football and barefoot kids in the favelas playing the beautiful game, into realising that you know, Brazil was a far more complex place and they had a real point, which I think is going to be the story of the World Cup rather than the football, I'm afraid.
It's a fantastic read. When Friday Comes, well, I recommend it as one of my books of the year last year. I have a feeling 31-0 on the road with football's outsiders, a World Cup odyssey, could well be there again this year. Published by Bloomsbury. James Montague, many thanks for your time as always.
Thank you very much.